Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lebel. What is the possibility of a negotiated end to the conflict in Ukraine? There are some indications NATO has shifted its position from total victory on the battlefield to the need of negotiations. At this point, this is unclear. The biggest barrier, of course, is lack of trust. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Glenn Diesen in Oslo. He is a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway, as well as author of the book, Great Power Politics in the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And here in Moscow, we have Dmitry Babich. He is a political analyst and editor at InnoSme Internet Media Project. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, let's start with Glenn in Oslo. Glenn, you know, over the last week, couple of weeks here, we've getting a lot of mixed signals out of NATO, to the point it seems to me, looking at their discourse, is that it's turning into a modicum of panic, worrying about escalation and the need for negotiation. The rhetoric that Ukraine is winning seems to be fading away. So read the tea leaves for me. Where are we right now? Go ahead.
Well, in any conflict, it's not easy, but it's possible to foresee when each party will be inclined towards negotiating. So, for example, when both sides believe they can win, then there's little chance of negotiation. Obviously, NATO has been quite optimistic that they could win, which is why a lot of the rhetoric has been very, very well. Let's call it aggressive. So Russia will be defeated on the battlefield, as Boris Johnson said. You know, a bad peace will not be accepted, and so essentially, nothing short of a full victory would be acceptable. Some even talked about taking back Crimea, and you know, so it's very extreme. But now, of course, we see the winds have changed to some extent. I mean, the Ukrainian army has suffered very greatly on the battlefield now. Much of their manpower and equipment has been exhausted. The ability to supply them is also reduced significantly, as the weapon storages across the West are now being depleted. Also, the economic impact of this is causing much concern, especially in Europe. And as a result, you also see the political will to continue this war also declining. So there is a possibility that that there's more willingness now to negotiate. Indeed, this is what we've seen in the rhetoric. However, and I would add this, however, it's worth noting that only a few weeks ago, you had newspapers like the Washington Post arguing that because the public's becoming more war weary, it's important to give the image that we are trying to negotiate a peace. So it's never really clear, because in the war you have such a huge amount of focus on information warfare. So it is quite possible that this is simply, you know, to give an image that, you know, we're not preparing yet another
war. Both can be true at the same time also. Okay.
Yeah, that is true, because the West is not one uniform voice. Even within each country, there are like competing voices. Even in the United States, in Washington, some want a quick end to this now, before the winds now start to, you know, blow in Moscow's direction, or, you know, Moscow starting to have great victories, while others see this as, you know, an opportunity to bleed Russia in the long run.
You know, Dima, it's very interesting that Putin talks quite frequently with media and public organizations about what's going on in Ukraine. And he made it clear that this could be a long effort. He's not hiding the fact, okay? But at the same time, he's saying everything is on course. I think one of the things that makes it very difficult to conceptualize this conflict is that the two different sides have very different goals. Russia's goal is to demilitarize Ukraine. That's very different than victory or regime change. It's demilitarization. And that is, as Glenn has already explained to us, that's happening at a pace that the Kremlin seems to be comfortable with. So because there's different perception, let me go to Dima on this one, different perceptions here, is that this adds to the confusion of what ending this conflict would be. Go ahead, Dima.
Well, the West likes to talk about Russia not fulfilling its plans. It's obvious, they say, that when the special military operation was started on February 24th. Of course, Putin did not foresee that there would be the battle for Mariupol and that there would be this long, protracted fight. Maybe. The question is, what does the West want? I mean, they're even less clear about it. Just take the last week, how many contradictory messages we had. And I'm not quite sure that the West is not speaking with one voice. There is a very bad voice that dominates. Let me give you an example. President Macron just said that Russia's security concerns should be considered at the negotiation that we will have at some point when Ukraine, well, basically can speak from the position of force. And, you know, so many people lashed out at Macron and no one defended him. Well, it's clear that Macron is a hypocrite. He speaks with many voices. Today, he says that he wants to call Putin. Tomorrow, he calls Russia an evil empire. So basically, he's not serious. So I would not like our viewers to think he's a peacemaker.
Yeah, but I mean, at this point here, sorry, but why would someone like Vladimir Putin take Macron's telephone call? Well, what could he possibly say? I mean, because the point is, let me go to Glenn here, because it's Washington that matter. It's not Berlin. It's not Paris. It's not London. It's Washington. OK, and I want to talk about the interview that Merkel gave to the media. That'll back up my thesis here. So, I mean, you know, Glenn, why should anybody in the Kremlin pick up the phone? I mean, what are these people saying? What have they said for the last 10 months that would be meaningful?
Well, I guess we can draw on the experience from in December and January, and that was quite clear Moscow didn't really care much what the EU had to say, didn't really care what Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg had to say. The main phone call, the one worth taking, was the one from Washington, because at the end of the day, that's where the decisions will be made. Macron is... he often plays the role of the great, you know, the great leader capable of doing this, you know, huge visions for a new Europe. But he said all of this for many years. Indeed, this idea that Russia is a part of Europe, you know, it has to be included. They've said this for 30 years now. So I think when it really came down to it and Russia asked, okay, these sentiments, convert them into actual security guarantees for us, nothing ever came from Macron. So, and this, again, it's not suggesting he's only weak, but also, as you hinted towards, he doesn't have the support from the Americans, not necessarily from the rest of the Europeans either. So, and France isn't that powerful. They can't swing the whole West. They don't they don't even speak for Europe. So it is a positive sign, though. At least we're talking about how to negotiate, because for so long now, negotiations was a naughty word, one you shouldn't say. It was the equivalent of appeasement. So the fact that, you know, you have people like on the U.S. side, which is more optimistic, General Milley, who suggested now is the time to negotiate. I don't think we can get more out of this war than we already have. Of course, Jens Stoltenberg, because I think to a large extent, he speaks on behalf of Washington as well. And he also had a very aggressive rhetoric suggesting the only acceptable peace was full victory on the NATO-Ukrainian side. And now, of course, he's arguing that the diplomacy has to be the path towards resolving this.
I'm glad you brought it up, because I have a quote from him. I'm going to throw it to Dima right now. This is Stoltenberg, the last news cycle here. But we have to pay a much higher price if our freedom and peace are threatened through Putin winning in Ukraine. Again, this is asymmetrical here. What is he talking about? Freedom and peace. Russia is talking about security, and that's what these negotiations should be about. Or, Dima, we can just go back to December 17th of last year as a starting point, okay? We didn't have to go through all of this if NATO and Washington had taken Russia's security demands seriously. Dima.
Well, it reminds me of Orwell, you know, war is peace, freedom is slavery. And as John Rowling joked recently, the fake transgender guy who raped you is a woman. So basically, it's all absurd. And some analysts in Russia called Macron a faux hooligan. who calls you saying that he's a negotiator and then sends artillery pieces, you know, to Ukraine as if he was somehow mediating while sending artillery pieces. Basically, what I want to say is that this evil voice that prevails in the West is it always prevails. I mean, just to remind you, it prevailed in January when Russia made these suggestions. And what it got from the West were just formal answers like, we are a peaceful defensive alliance. You have no reason to worry. Yes, we had reason to worry, unfortunately. The same story with other suggestions of negotiations. Just recently, there were signals from the United States that they were not quite happy with Zelensky, that they were not happy with the murder of Daria Dugina. And then today, last week, we actually get messages from the Times and from Politico, who quote American officials, Pentagon officials, saying the United States gave green light to Ukraine to strike at targets deep inside Russia using drones. So the evil voice is always the last one. They always prevail, you know. In the end, they always opt for war. They always opt for the military solution. And this is a very dangerous situation because we don't know where it will stop. You know,
well, Dima, what makes it dangerous is that if it's going to be a test of escalation, Russia can out-escalate NATO six ways to Sunday. I mean, it can't work, okay? And that, Glenn, that is the dilemma, because what NATO is doing is it has a political agenda and it has a military one, and they're not necessarily aligned. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, yeah, and I would also add that part of the reason that divides NATO and Russia is a fundamental different view in terms of what creates security. So for NATO, they tend to subscribe to the concept of liberal hegemony, in which, you know, the world is divided between democracies and authoritarians. In other words, good between good and evil. So the more power the side of good has, that is NATO, vis-a-vis Russia, the more peace it will have, which is why, you know, the catchphrase is always, oh, well, we need to negotiate from position of strength. In other words, dictate, because this is how you create peace, when the good guys have all the power. Now, this is very different from how Russia sees the world, which focuses more on the security dilemma, that you have competing centers of power, and they have to find ways of harmonizing their security interests. Now, obviously, if you think the world is divided between good and evil, then harmonizing or finding a common peace with Russia, it's very well, that's when we use the word appeasement, because anytime.
Yeah, but they're antithetical. You can't do that. OK, I mean, it's a perversion of its own logic here. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Dima here in Moscow. Dima, Angela Merkel gave a very curious interview in the last couple of days, and I think it can be interpreted in a number of different ways. I mean, obviously, she was criticized by basically pulling the veil back and saying that the Minsk process was really not real. It was buying time for Ukraine and for NATO to build up Ukraine's defensive and offensive capacities here. I'm not really sure I necessarily believe her rendition post fact like this, because I think that she's trying to justify her policy that essentially failed. But if you look at it from the Russian side, well, then obviously these people were not serious. The Germans weren't serious. The French weren't serious. And why would they be serious now if they want negotiations? I think Merkel really damaged any kind of the glimmer of hope that there could be talks in the immediate future. Go ahead, Dima.
Well, it was always a mystery for me why we Russians tend to excuse Frau Merkel. I mean, there's that myth in Russia that somehow she was good. She was just pretending to be bad. You know, just look at facts. Okay, look at video images. If you don't believe newspapers, you know, Merkel meets Yanukovych in November in Vilnius. Yanukovych used his right, absolutely legal right, to postpone the signing of the association agreement with the European Union. Then what does Frau Merkel say? We expected more. We expected more. And then the rebellion in Kiev starts, in which 38 policemen were killed and hundreds maimed. And they want to kill Yanukovych. And Frau Merkel supports it, you know. I think all doubts should end there. And then, you know, the Ukrainian government cracks down on the people who voted for Yanukovych and who wanted to defend their vote in the east of the country, where he stems from, basically. Yanukovych was born in the east. So she approves the military action of the Ukrainian government there. They get defeated at the battleground. They're retreating. And then she starts negotiations, yes, buying time, gaining time. Actually, not buying time because they didn't cede any territory. She just saved them from defeat, but they continued to bombard Donetsk for 8 years after that because they didn't retreat far enough from Donetsk. So I think the reason why so many people in the world are deceived is because Putin gave her flowers. Well, my theory about it is that the president has to be diplomatic. He has to give flowers sometimes to awful people, you know. But that doesn't mean our press, that doesn't mean our society should be as diplomatic as he is. He was trying to save peace. We can say the truth. She was a liar. She was a very important force behind this war. She bears enormous responsibility for the crash of the relations between Russia and Europe in the last 16 years.
Yeah, but absolutely. I agree with you completely, Glenn. But this brings up this credibility issue here. I mean, lied to once. Why wouldn't your interlocutor lie to you again? I mean, we don't even have a basic playing field right now to even start starting talks to start talks, if you know what I mean. That was it's an amazing revelation coming from Angela Merkel. Like I said, I think she could be playing a Monday morning quarterback now. Okay, and I think there is an element of that there, but. For the Russians, the element of trust is about zero right now. That's why I have said on this program repeatedly, this conflict will come to an end when Russia says it's over, okay, and it achieves its goals, because it's not going to get achieve those goals through negotiation. It's going to get achieve those goals unilaterally through the use of force. Glenn.
Well, what you and Dima are referring to is this huge lack of trust, which is necessary to have the trust if you're going to have an actual negotiation and a compromise and a political settlement. Now, obviously, the mutual trust is quite broken on both sides. So for West, they look at Russia and especially, after the invasion and the annexation of these new four regions, that this was a huge breach. But of course, Russia, as you're correctly arguing, has its own reasons to be doubtful. I mean, why would they trust this now? And it's worth going back how far the agreements have been broken. Because, yes, why would they sign something now? The reason why, from Russia's perspective, this war now is because the West never honored the Minsk agreement. They sabotaged it for 7 years. This has been not just by Merkel and Poroshenko, but it's largely accepted also on the American side. It's been sabotaged. And the only reason why we had the Minsk agreement is because a war broke out. And why did the war break out? Because after the Western governments helped to support this regime change in Kyiv. And in fact, if you remember, during the regime change, we had there was also an agreement. It was supposed to be a unity government. The Germans being one of the guarantors for having a unity government, which they then abandoned the following day and instead gave all the legitimacy they could to the new government that took power in this coup. And then again, you can go so far back because all the way since the end of the Cold War, it's just been broken agreements one after another. Keep in mind that in 1990, we signed agreements in 1994 that we're going to have a common Europe without dividing lines. Then we broke it by expanding NATO. And then even the EU signed agreements with Russia in 2005 saying, listen, we're not going to, if we're going to engage with common neighborhood countries like Ukraine, we're going to harmonize it. Not one integrate at the expense of the other. Well, obviously the EU broke that. That's why we ended up in the Maidan as well. So it's just been this one breach of agreement after another. So, and the problem is it's very difficult, at least the way I see it here in the West. Now, nobody's willing to put themselves in the shoes of Russia to understand how kind of we betrayed all the agreements we had with them year after year, because then, you know, you become a Putinist and a Russia apologist overnight, and you know, largely canceled. So it is a very difficult the ability to see from the other side is very much diminished, which means there can't be any foundation for trust. There's no recognition of mutual interest, and if there is no recognition of mutual interest, you tend to fall into these narratives of good versus evil, and again, there's no foundation for compromise or trust then.
You know, Dima, it's very interesting. I really like how Glenn just phrased it there, because the what I call the global majority, when people say the global South, but they really are the global majority, they actually do not see it the way the West does. They actually are far more sympathetic to Russia's interpretation and dealing with the West, because the global South has had its issues dealing with the West over the centuries. So there's a lot more sympathy there on the part of the global South when it comes to Russia's interpretation to this conflict.
Well, indeed, the Western press likes to say, oh, Putin achieved the opposite result. You know, now Sweden and Finland want to join NATO, and the NATO is united more than ever. Well, there was also another result from their action. Now China wants to buy oil from Saudi Arabia for Chinese currency, okay? Now India wants to buy oil from Russia, right? And now everyone is talking about moving away from the dollar as the universal exchange currency, which is a huge threat to the United States. Russia didn't want it. China didn't want it. It was the United States that brought it upon itself by this war of sanctions, because everyone in the East is looking, okay, they basically froze 300 billion Russian money. They can do it tomorrow to us. They can do it to Hungary. You know, if they don't like Orban well enough, they can
The EU is already threatening him with all cutting off of all kinds of
funds. Exactly. So they don't tell the whole story as usual. You know, there are many consequences. But Glenn is absolutely right. There was a breach of agreements on their side, but they have their own narrative. They say, oh, Russia did not respect the Charter for New Europe, which we basically signed with Gorbachev in 1990. I'm sorry, it was wishful thinking, you know, this Charter for New Europe. It was like something, I'm against global hunger. Okay, you know, we're all for United Europe. Problem is, how do we get it, you know? So they have their own narrative about Russia breaching agreements, and it is very well developed in Eastern Europe. The problem is that if the West continues to rehabilitate, as it was written in, I guess, the Independent last week, if they continue to rehabilitate Eastern Europe, kind of excusing them for any kind of Russophobia, they can end up very badly, because there will be no negotiation at all. I remember how our President Medvedev came to Poland, you know, when he was in power. And Poland was very anti-Russian already. He made a courageous move. He came to Warsaw, and there was a crowd standing next to them. I think the Polish authorities deliberately allowed it, yelling, "Tutaj Polska, a nie Rosja." Here it's Poland, here it's not Russia. The idiotic slogan, but it reflects the mood of some of the people in Eastern Europe. They don't want negotiation. And if you want to pin your hopes for negotiation on their position, you are never going to have.
Well, I mean,
you are going to have a permanent war.
Exactly, Glenn, because these people that do not want to have negotiations de facto do not want to have any kind of mutual agreed upon security arrangement in Europe. That is the worst possible outcome. I mean, and if it's all or nothing, my way or the highway, then we're not going to see security in Europe.
No, and this is obviously the main problem we have. But the Europeans are quite divided on this issue, though. I mean, Dima mentioned that, you know, NATO's all united now, but I think that was initially because of the shock and concern and, you know, taken by surprise as Russia invaded. But I think the longer this goes on, you're gonna see more. More divisions also within Europe, but of course these divisions can also then obstruct any peaceful negotiations. But again, I think at the end of the day, you know, for example, what the European, Eastern Europeans think. I don't think it matters as much as what Washington wants. Mm-hmm. So it is quite possible that a compromise can be reached. I mean, I even saw, you know, me speculating perhaps that, you know, Russia would at some point even be willing to negotiate, you know, giving up it's called newly acquired territories on the western bank of the Dnieper River. I mean, the western bank, but again, it's not certain. And again, the main challenge for Russia now is, what would any peace agreement look like? Because it would have to, like, the Americans wouldn't allow for example, recognizing any newly acquired territory. But for Russia, it would need a final peace because, as you suggested, if they don't get any guarantees, then this peace agreement will just be a temporary ceasefire. In other words,
the topic for a future edition of Crosstalk. That's all the time we have. But I want to thank my guests in Oslo and here in Moscow. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.